Welcome into the BBP. This is the Bengals Beat Podcast presented by Inquirer Sports. Here, your Cincinnati.com Bengals beat writers, Paul Diener Jr. and Jim Ossarski, invite you beyond the headlines and inside Paul Brown Stadium for the scoop on all things Bengals. Find out the insider news as well as listening on conversations with players, coaches, and others relevant to the club. Remember, you can subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Just search Inquirer Bengals Beat Podcast. And as always, you can listen on our free Cincinnati Inquirer Bengals app. If you don't have the app, well, I suggest rectifying that situation immediately in the App Store. Now, if you're down with BBP, let's go. All right, welcome in the latest edition of the BBP Bengals Beat Podcast. Paul Diener Jr. and Jim Ossarski, Bengals Beat Writers at Cincinnati.com, are here. And our 50 influential Bengals for 50th season series is rolling on. And with this week, we're getting into organizational figures. Yes. So a lot of coaches, people like that, through the years that have played a major role are part of it. And really, nobody has to deal more with coaches, Jim, than us.
That's true.
And the scribes. We see it all. We sort of experience everything that organization has. So this week, media roundtable from sort of the last three generations. I have former Inquirer beat writer from 81 to 89, Mike Dodd. Now retired, living the good life down in Tennessee after working for USA Today for a number of years as well. He also covered the Bills before the Bengals. But he bookended his career with Super Bowls. Not a bad deal if you want some excitement. Started in his first season covering the club, covered Super Bowl 16. And then his last season covering the club for the Inquirer, he was in Super Bowl 23. The second guy I have on this, I'm going to bring in Alex Marvez, who, while Alex was only – he covered the Bengals, people might realize this, in 95-96. He was only there for 2 years, but he's now with SiriusXM, Sporting News. He's a national guy. He really brings in a really nice perspective of how the Bengals fit – into the broader spectrum, which, Jim, really kind of gets lost a lot. The Bengals become a bit of a flyover team when it comes to national coverage and how right. people view their perception. And Alex, he can do a pretty good job of seeing the Bengals' unique spot.
Yeah, definitely. And especially, you mentioned 95-96, you know, he hits... I mean, really, did you need any more than two seasons in that era? You know, it's kind of like that's all you need, right? But you're right, though. It's to be able to lend both that sort of inside perspective. Obviously, he's remained close with Mike Brown over the years, and to then be able to pull it back a little bit and put you know, a little before and after along with his that couple window period. I do think Alex, you know, we all get along with Alex and. He's a good guy, and I think 2 years. 2 years is like it's like four. It's like dog years in the 90s, right?
Yeah, I joked with him during the podcast about how he probably was there for the two best years of the 90s.
He was.
That's really sad because he still didn't see a winning season. But you know, he ended up offering some really really interesting perspective, particularly into Mike in the national landscape. I thought so. I hope you all enjoyed that. So about 23 minutes with Alex Marvez. And then I wrap up the podcast today with longtime Bengals PR man Jack Brennan, who was a scribe before that. I mean, he's been around the Bengals since 1984, really 32 years around the club. He sort of spans all the generations. And we spent a lot of time getting into a lot of who these players were and stories of behind the scenes that people might not realize or might not have known. He tells a couple of just really good Chad Johnson stories, which, you know, people, if these PR directors could talk, right? I mean, you can't have a guy who you probably want to hear more stories about how the PR director had to deal with him than Chad.
Right. And again, I think that was an important thing there, Paul, too, because it's like you said, you know, Jack was on, quote unquote, our side of things, if you will, as a beat guy. I mean, Sam Weiss still laughs about how Jack tracked him down at Lunkin when he was, well, if it's Sam, he's fired. If it's Mike, he wasn't fired. But that whole thing, you know, Jack's running to an airport and doing that part of the job, and you're right, then to transition to work on the team side. Again, another guy who, a voice people probably, no, they haven't heard since he left, you know, traditional media. I mean, as a PR guy, you want to be a behind-the-scenes facilitator to help us do our job. So I think it's great that, you know, Jack's retired now and can kind of share all of this with all of you.
And I mean, if it sounds folksy and down home, it's because it is. I literally did it in his living room with his dog hanging out by my feet. It's a laid back interview, and Jack really just being himself, funny, honest, all those good things. So a lot else going on with the organizational figures week. You've got a couple coming, a bunch of stuff on all the coaches already out. And we're going to, you know, we kind of, you concocted this idea and we really jumped on board with it. And our video guy, Mike Nyerges, who did The Curse of Bo last week, in case you haven't seen it, you'll want to watch that video. We've got a really good one about just a great story. It's just a great yes. story.
Yeah. It focuses around Sam Weiss and the end of the 87 season, which Bengals fans might not remember. I mean, it was a strike-affected year. Team collapsed from verge of the playoffs in 86 to a 4-win team. And really, Boomer being the head of the union, obviously Mike Brown not really feeling that too much. Sam caught in the middle as a former player right back in the day. Now he's the coach. A lot of back and forth in the media. So really, those guys tell a story about Sam, Boomer, and backup quarterback Mike Northseth deciding, hey, you know what, maybe we need to bury this hatchet, bury this strike animosity. We've got a good team. And, yeah, Paul, it's a really cool story about, and really one that honestly Boomer and Sam say got them on the right track to go to a Super Bowl in 1988. It's I don't think it's been reported, and it's some fun stuff, some personalities there that really bring that to life. So that'll be really good for you at the end of this week.
Yeah, I know when I heard it, I was laughing pretty hysterically. So I look forward to everybody being able to go watch that. So we'll have that for you. Sam Weiss and Bill Walsh, you know, two names that really dominated the 80s, and some interesting stuff from Bill Walsh. You know, I don't think a lot of people realize about his motivation.
Yeah, Paul, you know, everyone kind of knows, obviously, he was passed over by Paul Brown in the late 70s for Tiger Johnson, goes to San Francisco. But look, Joe Montana, Eddie DeBartolo, Jerry Rice, Bruce Coslett, who played under Bill Walsh, Sam, who played and then coached under Bill Walsh, all of them, Paul, say, when it came to Cincinnati, Bill Walsh had an extra motivation, an extra fire. Dan Bunz, the famous stop in Super Bowl 16, said there was a vengeance there. There was a fire with Bill Walsh when it came to the Bengals. And why is that? Because, you know, Eddie DeBartolo said until the day he died, he carried that pain of being passed over. And Paul Brown kind of affecting his pro career immediately after leaving Cincinnati, it really hurt him. I think Bruce Coslett or Sam said it used the word wounded. I mean, it deeply affected him throughout his entire life. And on the football field, you know, clearly that came back to bite the Bengals, you know, in two Super Bowls and really what could have turned around that decade. In Cincinnati. Yeah. That was really interesting, Paul. I mean, I think we all kind of know that a little bit, but to hear it again, just really from those guys and just, you know, even some of the Bill Walsh's former players in Cincinnati sort of a lamenting, like, only if. And, you know, it's a disappointing thing, I think, for the Walsh family and then even, you know, obviously Bengals fans.
Yeah. Last week, when we did the Outsiders, I felt like there was a lot of negativity. Like it was like, okay, we were kind of opening a lot of wounds that maybe had previously healed a little bit and just kind of pouring some salt in there. And, you know, it was just, that's kind of part of what the Outsiders element is. People that, you know, and this week, a little bit more upbeat. Talk about guys, Forrest Gregg, the positive things that we've seen. Marvin Lewis, a lot of these other guys, a lot of positivity with Sam Weish. And the comedy club story, all that. Dave Shula's at the end, though. Look, you can't.
Right.
You just can't not. You can't skip over when you talk about influential and not talk about the losingest coach by the percentages ever until Gus Bradley came along and jagged it up.
Right, exactly. And Dave was great. He opened up for the first time, I think, in 15 years. I think Doc tracked him down, you know, 5 years after he was fired, and Dave opened up about a lot of stuff, and you know, it was interesting. There's things he definitely wishes he could do better, but in the end, you know, he says he can't really blame it all on me. So, you know, it is interesting, Paul. This week, these guys have been really good, from Dick LeBeau to Bruce Coslett, you know, guys who maybe are associated with their brief head coaching tenures. But really had a greater impact on the team and the league far beyond, you know, say a Dave Shula, who only had that head coaching experience. And obviously Sam Weish, influential from not only being on the 49ers sideline and coaching up Joe Montana in Super Bowl 16 to the invention of no huddle along with Bruce Coslett. So some really interesting stuff and a lot of context, I think, that people only maybe remember bits and pieces from these guys, either as head coaches or just, you know, obviously Bill Walsh invented the West Coast here in the late 70s when Greg Cook got hurt.
Yep. So all that on the site this week, Cincinnati.com. Make sure you check it out. Pick up our Bengals app. You'll need that to get all of our content there. And of course, you know, hopefully you listen to, you already subscribe on iTunes or on Audio Boom. To the podcast is going to keep coming with you. Next week, we're going to move into offensive players, and I can only tease. I'm not going to tell you who I got, and I'm going to be having a blowout package on. But I'll only say this: it is literally the white whale interview I have been chasing since the day I got hired here, and I'm happy to say finally did it. And those types of things rarely live up to expectations. This one blew it out of the water. I think everyone's going to be excited about it. That's all I'm saying. It's the only tease I'm doing. But next week, trust me, is going to be an absolute must listen for anybody that's been a Bengals fan for any amount of time, and even if you haven't. So come back for that. In the meantime, Mike Dodd, former Bengals writer for the Cincinnati Inquirer in the 80s. Alex Marvez, who covered the Bengals, currently with SiriusXM. And the sporting news, he was here in 95 and 96, brings in the national perspective, and we close it out with former Bengals PR director, recently retired PR director, and former scribe, as he says, I'll always at heart be a scribe, Jack Brennan closes it out. So enjoy those conversations, a lot of Bengals history in there, really, really interesting behind-the-scenes stories from these guys. So hope you enjoyed that. And we'll be back on the BBP next week with the offensive players edition. We'll talk to you later.
All right, moving on here on our Bengals 50 podcast as we continue to look back through some of the history of 50 seasons of the Cincinnati Bengals. And, you know, you could make an argument that the Bengals were Joe Montana away from being the team of the 80s. And that decade was really a special one for this franchise, and they're documenting 7 seasons of it. For my employer, Cincinnati Inquirer, was Mike Dodd. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Paul, it's a pleasure. Glad to talk to you.
Absolutely. Now, you had my job back in the day, although you saw a little bit more success in the playoffs. Your first season, the Bengals go to the Super Bowl in Detroit. And then in your last season, the Bengals go to the Super Bowl in Miami. That's not bad bookends for your time spent in the Queen City.
Yeah, it was, and you know, I'll never forget. I covered the Buffalo Bills for the Buffalo Evening News before I came to Cincinnati, and I covered them for 4 years, and they were pretty miserable. And then in 1980, they went to the playoffs. They turned it around. And when I interviewed with the Inquirer, the managing editor then was Jim Schottelcotti, great guy and a great ME. And I said to him, we kind of kidded. I said, well, you know, the team's been pretty miserable the last 2 years, the Bengals. And I said, well, I have a lot of experience in losing, with covering losing teams, you know. And we laughed about that. And he said, oh, you'll be a real good fit here, he said. And sure enough, my first year, they turned it around and went to the Super Bowl. So we laughed about that a lot over the years.
Yeah, you know, you spend some time, you talk about an opportunity. I was talking about this job. It's not really about whether a team wins or loses. What you really remember are really the personalities. And, boy, there were personalities during your time with Bengals. You know, whether you're talking about the huge personality of Paul Brown, Sam Weish, or Boomer Esiason, and so many more, who's some of the more underrated personalities that maybe people don't talk enough about from your time here that still stick with you today that you remember covering?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, Pete Johnson was a character, and you know, Icky Woods in his brief time there. But Icky was kind of, I always thought everything was sort of staged with him, you know, whereas other guys were just sort of naturally colorful. And probably the best guy I ever covered, in my whole, including the 4 years I covered the Bills, was Collinsworth. He was just a character, and he understood the role of the media. And I really liked covering Esiason as well. He was the same. Both those guys sort of got it. They knew what their responsibilities were with the media and enjoyed it. Didn't try to fight it. But Collinsworth was just a total character. I mean, I can, you know, he'd always have a story for you. I mean, if you're looking for a couple of notes, you went to his locker. He was just terrific, and obviously a real student of the game, as it's shown now. I mean, he's just so good on TV. But he was a bright guy, and I think he knew he wasn't. He was tall and skinny when he came in. Knew he was going to take a pounding, and probably wasn't going to have a long career. He probably had a longer career than he expected, but, you know, went to law school midway through his time in the 80s, that planned on being a lawyer. I think took a different path with his career, highly successful, but he was just an absolute character. And he kind of would, you know, he really understood the role. And his locker at Old Spinney Field was kind of right across from a bunch of the defensive backs. And I remember one stretch where the DBs weren't playing very well at all, and I was pretty critical of them. And I went over to talk to someone down that aisle, and one of the DBs started giving me a lot of grief and whatnot. Collinsworth kind of interrupted him and said, "Hey, man, there's no such thing as bad publicity. You know, you're getting pub, you know, joking with him," but in a way kind of defending me. And that didn't happen very much then. I'm sure it happens even less now, you know. It's just... He just kind of got it, and he sort of diffused the situation with a player that it wouldn't have come to anything. But he just was that sort of guy.
Yeah. I mean, it's really no surprise then when you talk about a guy like Collinsworth, a guy like Esiason, guys that were around the team at that time have gone on to do so well nationally in television. I think a lot of that stems from Sam Weish, too. Do you think that's the case? I mean, Sam was a master at playing the media and creating stories and making sure that if he wanted to be the story, he knew he could just go to the media at any time. Do you think that maybe was connected to Sam's openness with the media that he was?
Yeah, no, well, Sam was, in a different way. But I think with Esiason and Collinsworth, it was just their personalities. Mm-hmm. And both of them came from big, pretty good-sized, you know, Maryland and Florida, good-sized college programs. So they weren't, they were used to dealing with the media. But Sam, you're exactly right on one thing. I mean, he created copy, and he created issues where there were none, you know. which was great for the media, but sometimes it would drive you crazy covering the team. I got enough to do without, this issue you just created after practice today. He did that, and I think it was a year after I left, he had the bit about the woman reporter in the locker room. Again, another example of kind of making an issue where there was none. And I think they had the bad year in 87, the strike year, and he was just so pro management that he turned off the team, and they struggled. And I think that Paul and Mike, everyone expected him to be fired. I certainly did. And Paul and Mike sat him down. First of all, they looked at the field of potential replacements and said, is there anyone coming in? Because they knew they had a team with a ton of talent. And some of those guys were getting up in age, and so they we have to win now. And they said, is there anyone out there that, what is our best chance of winning next year? And they came to the conclusion that it was Sam, but if they could corral him a little bit. And they sat him down and they said, okay, you're going to keep your job, but here's a couple of stipulations for it. You're not going to be there till 1 a.m. every night. Go home and get your sleep, and don't create issues where there are none. They reined him in terms of his time with the media and his exposure to the media, and he took the advice, and he was a different coach in '88, and obviously they went to the Super Bowl, and I think he sort of regressed a little bit later on that score, but he certainly put it together for him in '88.
Yeah, he did. An incredible turnaround that year. I want to go back to the beginning, your first Super Bowl, your first year on the beat. You come in and, first of all, I just want to ask about the Freezer Bowl, because the local legend in Cincinnati now is 500,000 people say they were there that day, even though there was only 46,000. But you were there, and
right.
So I mean, the first question is obvious: is how cold was it? I mean, was it the coldest day you've ever come across? And what's your memories of the Freezer Bowl as a whole?
Yeah, a lot of great memories, personal and professional. And no, it actually wasn't, but it was right up there. Coldest football game I ever covered, that's for sure. I had the good fortune of covering the Lillehammer Olympics when I went to USA Today, and that was Norway in February, a serious cold. But that game was amazing. And, there's so many stories, which are legend, the offensive linemen saying we're not wearing, long sleeves, and they definitely psyched the Chargers out. And of course, there are always the stories that the Chargers always insist that, when they were going towards the riverside or driving towards the river, that the gates were open, so the wind was blowing in and South couldn't pass. And when Anderson and the Bengals, were driving towards that side of the field, the gates at Riverfront Stadium were closed, so there wouldn't be the wind coming through. Honestly, I was too cold to catch it. I don't know. Probably was true. And Riverfront Stadium didn't have granted, I was inside. And I was pretty bundled up, but I was inside. Not like the fans sitting outside, and they were unbelievable to sit through that. But the heat in the press box in Riverfront Stadium was like on a scale of 1 to 10, maybe a 2, It was reasonably cold there, but at least we didn't have the wind blowing on us. It was enclosed, and it was much more comfortable than the people outside. But we went down to the field in those days. The media, they used to let the media on the field with about 2 minutes to go, and so we all made a point to go down there and get a sample of it, and it was just unbelievably brutal. And I'll never forget being on the field and just seeing. There were some newspapers that blew onto the field, and just to give you an idea, the wind was just swirling. The wind was constantly swirling there. It wasn't just the cold; it was also the wind chill. I think it might not have Brooklyn might not have set the record for, in the NFL for coldest, but it did for wind chill or vice versa, I remember. But the, but there was a nasty wind there, and it was a swirling wind, and I can't imagine being out in that for 3 hours. Those guys were amazing, as were the fans, obviously.
Yeah, yeah, a legendary game, and I guess now these days it's one of the advantages of the modern era of football in our industry is we don't really have to worry about newspapers blowing in the wind to interrupt games anymore.
that's true. And on a personal note, real quickly, I had my wife was pregnant. We had like a 3 or 4 year old girl, and we had an old house out in Batavia, and we had it was an oil tank that was outside, and the feed into the house froze, and they had no heat during the game. And
oh.
she packed up our daughter and headed to the Eastgate Mall just to get some heat for the day. And I'll tell you, what are we talking now? 36 years later, I still hear about it. You know?
Yeah.
I said I wasn't exactly comfy, cozy, comfy there, but I had it better than you did.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Going to the Eastgate Mall for comfort—that's a good story right there. That's a good story right there. I want to kind of push forward a little bit into an overarching theme with this organization. That's, you know, the Brown family and Paul Brown. You know, Paul was around obviously in those days. What was access like with Paul, and what were your impressions of him? You know, he's such a legendary figure across the game now. I mean, what were your impressions of Paul in your time there?
You know, I admired him tremendously, and not just for you know the things he did before I covered him, which are legendary. But I also got to know him pretty well, and you know, he was very, very fair. And but he had a sense of humor where he could get at you a little bit if he wanted to, but he really was very fair about it. Again, he understood it. But yeah, a couple of quick Paul stories. My first year, 1981. You know, I come from covering the Bills, and I really didn't know him very well when I was in Buffalo. But that first summer, we were up at training camp in Wilmington College, and he would be at practice every day. And a lot of times, you know, I'd sidle up to him and chat with him during the practice. And you know, I'd ask him questions about the Bengals' early days or the Browns and whatever. And I guess about the first, probably the end of the first week or the second week, we had, you know, each paper had a dorm room in the dorms in Wilmington. I'm not sure if they still do that, but where they train now. But there was a knock on my door one day, and it was Paul, and he gave me his autobiography or his biography with autobiography co-written with Jack Clary, and it was inscribed with a very nice inscription. And I thanked him very much, and he was very gracious about it. But I also had this little sense like this was my homework, you know. This was required reading here, you know.
Yes.
You better read this every night up here, or have this book finished, you know, by the time we start the preseason games, because questions you're asking, as they say, oh, they're in the book, you know.
Yeah.
So, he was always good, or. You know, if you were critical of the team, and then a lot of times in training camp, he'd bring his friends up, and some pretty high-powered friends he had. I remember Neil Armstrong came up once or whatever, and he'd have friends, and I'd be standing on the sidelines, and he'd stand like 3 feet behind me and be explaining to his, you know, chatting with his friends, and certainly in a voice loud enough for me to hear, he'd say, and as you can see, our little outfit is in total disarray here right now, you know. Again, a little shot of something I'd written in the paper that day, a critical piece I'd written in the paper that day. We're in total disarray here, as you can see, you know. It's very definitely for my benefit. But he was very, very fair, and access to him was terrific. Anytime, you know, during the season, if you wanted to see him on a Monday after a game or whatever, he'd always make time for you, and he'd spend as much time with you as you wanted. And I made a point to, you know, if I'd written something that was critical of him, I made a point to go in and see him, you know, the next day or a day after. I mean, to give him a chance to vent or whatever, and he rarely did. There was one time I remember, I think the maddest he ever got at me in the years I covered it, was there was one game that they lost to the Jets that the team really lost its composure and had a couple of bad calls go against them. And Mary, his wife, was really upset at the officiating, and she came down. I was the pool reporter, and I went down to talk to the officials about a couple of their calls. And, you know, Mary, after she got off the elevator, made a little beeline for the officials' door at the old Riverfront Stadium and you know, gave them a piece of their minds. And I wrote it. And Paul was very upset at me for writing it. I mean, his point was, this is family, and that was out of bounds. And I, you know, so I went in to see him the next day because I knew he'd be upset. And that was the maddest he ever got at me, because you're dragging, you know, my non-football family into this. I told him I appreciated his point of view on it, but, you know, I just felt I had to, I felt I had to write it. But with the rest of the stuff, I mean, he basically understood criticism was part of the game, and it certainly, you know, debate issues with you by and large, but it was never personal. I didn't feel it was ever personal with Paul, and I really grew, the longer I covered the team, the more I grew to like him and admire him. I think, and you know, all he did for the game with the 40-yard dash and all of the innovations he brought to the game when he was with the Browns were amazing, and it was kind of special, and you had to feel good. The two Super Bowls, when, you know, he was obviously a big story, both the Super Bowls they went to, and yeah, it made you feel good that he was getting credit for his role there, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I could sit and listen to people tell stories about Paul Brown all day, and often it's funny when we if the Bengals play the Patriots, we'll do a conference call with Bill Belichick. He will also sit and tell stories about Paul Brown all day. There's just so much respect throughout the league that people just love talking about the man and what he was like and what he meant to the game, for sure.
I'm watching football on TV now, and my wife is tired of hearing it. I'm quoting Paul Brown all the time, and the one quote I always remember from him was, you know, the end zone celebration, which he hated, and he had a great line, and I've heard it from a lot of people before, but I think he was the originator of the line. He'd say, "Act like you've been there before."
Yeah,
you know. And that absolutely was Paul. And then, so the irony was, when Mickey Woods came in 88, started and gave them the power running back they needed and did the celebration, Paul went along with it. He was still, "Oh, no, you know, we'd run up to him. What do you think about that, Paul? What do you think about the Yankee shuffle?" And he said, "I kind of enjoy it, you know." But it was pretty ironic that, you know, this guy who got TV commercials and everything out of this silly dance, which I'm sure Paul couldn't stand, but he went along with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Mike, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day to join and tell stories about the 80s. It was a really, really interesting time, obviously, to cover the club, and I'm sure you came away with no shortage of stories from it, that's for sure. So I appreciate it. Hey, life is good now. Retired, living down in Nashville, all is well with you, huh?
Yeah, our daughters are grown, and they settled in Nashville. So I did the last 10 years of my career for USA Today in Chicago and loved it, but just was obviously when wanted to be close to our kids and our grandson. So we're enjoying it down here. I'm a Yankee, as you can tell from my accent probably, but as they can certainly tell from it down here. But we're enjoying it, and it's fun to follow the Bengals from a distance. I don't follow them as closely as I used to, obviously, but they're still, it's always been an interesting franchise, and they certainly remain the same.
Absolutely. Mike, again, congratulations on all that, on grandchildren and the success you've had and being retired and living the good life, and appreciate you spending your time chatting with us, and best of luck to you, everything in the future.
Okay, and good luck covering them this year, Paul.
All right, here we go on our Bengals 50 podcast, and I really feel like without talking to this guy, we would not be covering the Bengals the way that we truly need to when we look at the history of this team, and that is Alex Marvez of Sporting News, SiriusXM, one-time former, you know, you were a
Pro Football Writers Association head, and you covered the Bengals back in the mid-90s, but really when it was a special time in Bengals history then. Alex, thanks for joining.
No problem. Special, if you mean the struggle, yes, that was special indeed. But you know what, though? It was interesting because 95 and 96 were not low points for the franchise in that decade. In fact, you know, there was some optimism coming out of the 1995 season. It was a team that started 2-0 and made some strides as the year went on, even without Kajana Carter, the first-round pick, who had suffered that horrific ACL-MCL. So everyone's thinking in 96 that he's ready to recover, that this unit would be ready to legitimately compete for a playoff spot, but instead not to be. In fact, a very slow start under Dave Shula led to his midseason firing, a move that Mike Brown didn't want to have to make. He was a real big fan of Dave Shula, almost to a fault, because of the fact that Dave had the worst record of any head coach in NFL history until Gus came along and somehow managed to beat that. But, yeah, I mean, you know, but then Bruce Cosgrove took over, and again, a wave of optimism while I was there. But other than that, the 1990s, except for a little bit of Norman Julius Esiason late in the decade, not so much.
No, you know what's funny? You were at the high point of the 90s. You were at, you saw the best that the Bengals in the 90s had to offer.
I know, isn't that scary? I mean, and you know what? They actually had some guys that you thought, wow, they can really base this team around. You're talking about, you know, Jeff Blake, who at the time was considered a real up-and-coming passer. Carl Pickens, I mean, he still holds a streak of consecutive games with a touchdown. 10 straight games, the mark that still stands to this day, and he did that in the 94-95 seasons. You put Darnay Scott in there. They had a guy as a third receiver who was a pretty good kick returner in David Snoop Dunn. Tony McGee was still in his prime. You know, Willie Anderson comes on board in 1996. Obviously, he goes on to a career that I think should garner him Pro Football Hall of Fame consideration. So you think about that. I mean, there's a lot that went on with that Bengals team. Unfortunately, on the defensive side of the football, a little bit slower to come together. And it's interesting because I'm, you know, at SiriusXM NFL Radio, you know, we're putting together an all-time 50th anniversary Bengals team. And Paul, that's where I've had a little bit of a struggle on the defensive side of the football finding blue-chip players, you know, and there just didn't seem to be a whole ton of them. There were some good players, but when we talk about great linebackers in Bengals history, it's not a real long list. Great defensive linemen. You know, it just isn't. I mean, and you know, two modern era players, you know, there just haven't been a ton of blue chip guys that you say they got to be part of this 50th anniversary team. Some very good players, don't get me wrong, and ones who fit in the team fabric, but, you know, just not the type that, that truly will say, wow, this guy is destined for Canton.
You're exactly right. You know, we kind of, we threw together our list of the 50 most influential Bengals, and it was, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. And when we got into the players section, I mean, the list of offense is two and three times longer than the list of defensive players. It's just their franchises, that's sort of what they've been. They've always sort of, really, until of late, they've been an offensive franchise. Their most known players were all, whether you're talking about Ken Anderson or Boomer or even into Carson Palmer and obviously Anthony Munoz, Chad, they were offensive guys, their biggest stars, and so they just have never really been, until Mike Zimmer arrived, a defensive franchise. It's a really interesting dynamic that for that to continue on for 50 years is really hard.
Yeah, it is. It may be a trend, eh? But, you know, the thing, too, is, you know, Mike Brown has always felt this, and I learned this from him, you know, along the way, that he believes it all starts with a franchise quarterback. And that was his number one goal all the time, was to make sure that the Bengals had a franchise passer in the fold. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that maybe he never, in my mind, was never truly on board with Jeff Blake. And I think that Mike, he extended his contract, don't get me wrong, but I also think, too, in the back of his mind that Mike realized that this may be a player who ultimately has hit his high points early on in his career, and from that point forward is never going to be a you know, franchise type player that can take you to a Super Bowl. And in Jeff's case, it was interesting, you know, watching practice for 2 years, and that was one of the joys of covering the Bengals when I first started, was NFL practices were open. So I would spend hours every day out there watching practice and seeing guys. And Jeff, you know, after I leave the Bengals and I go to cover John Elway and the Broncos, I don't think John missed a pass where Jeff would be up, he'd be down, he'd be to the side, he'd be wide. It just was, you know, all these different things that went on there. But, yeah, and of course now we look at this defense, and last year, as you know, on the cusp of being a top 10 defense in Cincinnati, and maybe this year they can get over that hump, especially, you know, with some injuries and things like that. If they can get a full season out of Vontaze Burfict, if he doesn't do anything else to get himself suspended, maybe William Jackson contributes, a pretty deep safety class. I mean, you know, and of course some of these young defensive linemen as well are going to have to step up with DeMonte Paco now going to Denver. But, you know, I'm actually a little bit bullish on this Bengals team. I mean, and I know that's like heartbreak is awaiting me, right? But nonetheless,
yes.
I feel actually pretty good about this team, provided they can stay healthy, something they couldn't get done in 2016.
Yeah, no, you're right. I think that people have been waiting for the shoe to drop on the Bengals for 5 years and kept saying, well, they're going to be the team. They're always the team that's not going to make the playoffs again next year. They do it when everyone's filling time in the summer. Who's not going to make it back? It was always the Bengals are going to fall, and they never did until last year. So as soon as that happens, everyone's ready to pile on and cast them back because there's always this desire to view them as sort of a fraud because they've wanted to view their quarterback as a fraud. They've always wanted to view their coach as a fraud. There's been this desire for them to be that. And so everyone's hopping on, and I think there's those that have paid attention closely have seen that last year was probably more of an outlier when you look at some of the things that happened to them, both injury-wise and some of the games they lost and some of the dynamics of the season. It seems more like they're built to pop back rather than necessarily a trend where they're going to suddenly turn back into the 90s Bengals again.
Right, I agree with you. I really do, and I think that's, you know, especially, gosh, I mean, get a season out of Tyler Eifert. How do you replace all those touchdowns, especially mm-hmm. in a year that quite honestly, you're rebuilding at wide receiver, you know, and you have young Boyd who's at, you know, wide out. But other than that, what did they really have at that position beside A.J. Green? And then, you know, Cedric Ogbuehi, his development has just not been what initially was projected when he came out, a player who was regarded as a top five talent in that 2015 NFL draft class. You look at that situation, you know, I mean, there were just a number of things that have gone on with this Bengals squad that led to them taking a step back last year. But really, defensively in the second half of the season, they played much better. And I've got to think, too, now, if they can just keep these guys on the field, keep A.J. on the field, you know, get Gio Bernard back at some point, and when you add a John Ross and you add a Joe Mixon, these are explosive players. These are guys mm-hmm. that can score from anywhere around the field, and that's not cliche. That's fact. I mean, how many of those guys in the league are there? There's Odell Beckham Jr. There's not a ton of them that are out there that can turn any play into a touchdown because they're just that darn quick. So I think there's been a pretty nice retooling of the Bengals so far. Of course, though, there's some other questions that pop up. All in leadership is going to be one of those things. You know, who steps up now that Witt isn't there? Who steps up now that Paco isn't there? I mean, I want to know who these definitive leaders are on this Bengals team, guys that, you know, that you can truly respect and are going to be the ones that can handle some of the internal strife that comes along with every NFL season.
Yep, and we don't know who that is going to be. I want to jump into a historical topic here for you, and you've kind of touched on a few of the elements of this that I think are a part of it, and will always be a part of this team going forward in this current ownership structure. I mean, we're in a league now where really 3/4 of the league are business moguls. Owners are business moguls. They're guys. They own Home Depot, or you're Stan Kroenke, or Jerry Jones, and they're rich business guys. The football family is gone. You know, it's dwindling. It's not gone. It's dwindling. And you have people like the Browns. You have the McCaskies. You have this small group that's left. The Bengals are even rare amongst that small group. My question, I guess, to start is, what, from your perspective, from seeing the league and having been here, what makes the Bengals different? And what has made them different from the other 31 franchises?
I think it starts with Mike Brown, you know, yeah. and his perspective. You know, a lot of folks don't realize Mike was a lawyer before he started all of this, right, and running the team. You know, you're talking about a guy who back, you know, he was the one who helped fight to get his father back an NFL franchise following, you know, the split with Art Modell. And, you know, Paul Brown, the guy who's one of the incredible leaders of football all time, a guy who should arguably be on the Mount Rushmore of the most influential people in the history of this league, you know, gets thrown into exile with nowhere to go. So ultimately, Mike leads that charge. Mike has been there and done that. And he's now, you know, it's funny because initially it was everyone was poo-pooing the things that he said, and it's Mike is old-fashioned and he's a fuddy-duddy. No, Mike has always been, now he's regarded as a voice of reason, a voice of wisdom, someone who has seen everything that seems to have gone on in the NFL, and he has his opinions. Look, he doesn't like instant replay, for example. You know, he's not fond of that. There are certain things that you could say are an archaic in view, but he has perspective to back up his opinions, and I respect that. And that's what makes it different. You know, also the fact it's his money, you know? I mean, this is a team that has to have a budget, that has to run things a certain way so that this team can remain in the family, and that is Mike's desire, to have the Bengals remain in his family with Katie and you know, his daughter, who obviously is a huge part of this team, and her husband, Troy Blackburn, and little Paul Brown, PB, whatever you want to call him. I mean, you know, this is a desire to keep the Bengals strong for generations to come. And so I think there's a responsibility that Mike feels with that as well. And, you know, that's why you see – and I, you know, it's interesting because there's different ways to have a great scouting program, to have a great coaching staff. You know, one can say, oh, the Bengals, you know, they're – you know, for years it was this falsehood, this narrative that said, oh, well, the Bengals are terrible scouting department. They don't have enough people. They're too cheap. No, that wasn't really it. The problem was that Mike Brown was making picks based upon character issues sometimes that blew up in his face. And he was taking these high-risk, high-reward, you know, types of propositions, much like a Joe Mixon, so what's old is new again, right? But, you know, guys that you just wonder about the off-field character. And, Paul, they're drafting him, and, you know, they're drafting him too high. We think back to that 2005 draft class and just too many guys like that, you know, poisoning the team and just not being the types of guys that you want to have around. But it was mostly Mike making those decisions. And ever since he began working in conjunction with Marvin Lewis and obviously also adding Duke Tobin, they have really had a much better flow as far as their scouting goes. But I think that's what makes Mike unique. Listen, this is a team, too. When we talk about NFL and family, it's a tough deal, right? I mean, because, look, every player is expendable. From the minute that you're signed or drafted, the team is thinking about, okay, who do we have to get to replace him in case something goes wrong or this guy doesn't work out or they get old or they make too much money? I mean, you know, that's the reality of what you have. And, you know, but in their case, when it comes to taking care of their employees, so many of the same people when I started covering the team in 1995 are still there. You know, as long as you did your job, you know, they were going to let you stay. And you know, it's a tremendous thing there. You know, for you talk about the medical, you know, plans that that the employees have, the coaches have. You know, you may not be driving fancy cars every day to work, but you're not going to pay a dollar out of pocket when your child is born. I mean, things like that Mike does really quietly behind the scenes, I think, to make sure that there is that type of atmosphere, that people are taken care of, that they can do their jobs and know and not be in fear of being fired if things go bad. And Mike is more willing than most. He doesn't scapegoat others. He'll take the blame first and foremost for so many of the things that go on. And I think that's a commendable thing that, you know, I think a lot of people may not appreciate, Paul.
You're 100% right. And it's a word that I often find myself using with Mike and with this franchise, you know, because he sets the tone on it, and it's loyalty. And it's one that we constantly talk around the other 31 teams in the league is non-existent, right? It's cutting guys because you don't care because they're too, you know, they're getting older and contracts and this, that, and the other. This is a team that would rather take on a huge cap hit to a guy who has been good to them at the edge of the end of his career rather than just dip away on. So, I mean, Leon Hall is a prime example of that. We've seen that happen year in and year out with this team, where other teams would cut a guy, but they won't. They will hold on to him. And there's a loyalty, and it's not just as you mentioned, it's in the front offices, it's with the players, it's with coaches. You know, obviously, as we talked about Marvin Lewis, now the second longest tenured coach in the NFL, still without a playoff win. You talk about that. It's just a lost art in this league, and I just feel like they're the one team, really, maybe a few others, but they're really the one team still really holding that out there as number one.
Yeah, but you know, the flip side to it, Paul, which drives you sort of crazy if you try to figure all this out, why the Bengals don't have a better alumni situation. And they are reaching out now, and we are going to have, you know, a lot of, you know, players are going to be honored, 50th anniversary team this year as that celebration is going on. You know, Mike has always said, and this was his philosophy, and he shared this with me a few years ago, and I thought it was interesting, that essentially people of today don't really care too much about players of yesterday. He isn't that nostalgic type in that regard when it comes to these players. I also think, too, quite honestly, Paul, that some players, I think there's a concern from Mike that some of them may feel that even though they're that maybe just maybe that there's still a paycheck that's going to come from the Cincinnati Bengals, and there's a little bit of skepticism involved with Mike Brown about that as well. And I think one of the reasons that, quite honestly, this franchise has distanced itself from a lot of former players, and you know, it's just not the same. The alumni association hasn't been the same. I hope that this 50-year anniversary thing can become a little bit of a launching pad to better relations between this, and we could find a middle ground. I mean, Mike told me that there wasn't enough banner space at the stadium to really start a Bengals type of Hall of Fame, but I think there are ways to get this done, Paul. And you know, again, celebrate the history. It's interesting history. I tell you what, though, too, fans are into it, man. I mean, you know, the fact that they keep showing up year after year after year, right? And you know, they may get angry, they may vent, they may say a lot of things about it, but bottom line is that usually Paul Brown Stadium is full, and it is part of the fabric of the city of Cincinnati. I've seen it firsthand. Hamilton County, Northern Kentucky, whatever you want to call it, I mean, the Bengals play an important part in this community.
You're exactly right. And I think the one thing the community knows, someone, I grew up here, you know, I moved away and worked at a place for a while and came back and covered the Bengals for a while now. The one thing that I think the community just wants is to feel like the Bengals value the community. You know what I mean? And a part of that is reaching out and bringing former players that they loved back and having whether it's a ring of honor, just doing things that make them proud and make them feel connected to the team more. And I think that the organization does realize that it's like this 50th season is ways that they're going to try to start moving back in there. But there's a disconnect where there's almost the city often looks at them, they just are waiting to hate on them, you know? And I think part of that is something that you experienced is the 90s. It left a generational scar on the relationship when you have a team that was that bad and the whole stadium debacle and everything that went with it. I think it just left people a little scarred. And that's, I think that honestly, it's still there for a lot of people. And some, you know, and maybe it just started healing with some of these playoff runs, but that's still there. That's still a big part of the fabric of what they are right now.
Well, and think about this as well, and I agree with you. You know, look, when it came to Hamilton County and the tax, you know, that came in to keep the Bengals, and at the time, you know, there was a very real possibility that the Cincinnati Bengals would be on the move. I mean, heck, they were even being courted by Los Angeles at the time. And while I can't see Mike as Mr. Hollywood wearing dark, you know, Tom Cruise-like shades and cruising Ventura Boulevard, nonetheless, this was an option. You know, again, they were going to weigh all options and see, okay, where do we take our team? You know, all bets are off the table, but the you know, half-cent tax passed. But, you know, it was the folks in Hamilton County who bore the brunt of it. Those in Northern Kentucky didn't have that. There were just, you know, you didn't see real progress now. I mean, downtown Cincinnati is a burgeoning place, and as we know, over the Rhine is coming back. I mean, there's a lot of great things that are going on there. But at the time, in the 90s, you not only have, you know, a city feeling that they've given Mike Brown a handout, and even though the voters passed it, on top of that, you're not winning. And it's frustrating for everybody that's involved. And year after year, it's the same old Bengals, and they feel that they're cheap and they're not spending to be a good team. And, you know, and that sort of frustration continues to build. Now, I think they've gone a good ways toward changing that image. But you know what helped winning in the playoffs? And like you talked about, Paul, like they've been so – that's going to justify some things. Because, you know, until then, we can talk about what if, what was, what could have been. But, and you know, trust me, there's no team like the Bengals with that. What if, you know, Kimo von Ohlhofen doesn't go crashing into Carson Palmer's knee? What if Greg Cook doesn't hurt his shoulder in a basketball game back in the late 1960s? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, all of these crazy things that have happened to this franchise to set it back. But nonetheless, if they get that playoff win, you're talking about a new generation of Bengals fans who can feel pretty good about where that's headed. And that's the thing that we, you know, and I've sort of gained an education in that also. Like, for example, with Bob Stoops, there's a whole group of Oklahoma fans, a whole another generation that only grew up knowing Bob Stoops as their head coach after all that time there. So it's interesting, you know, now the Bengals, there's a whole generation that only know Marvin Lewis as their head coach because he's been there for so long, and now we got to see what they can accomplish in 2017 to, you know, continue to try to move this franchise into its next 50 years.
The best way to connect yourself and connect your team with a city and a fan base is to give them a moment, to give them that moment where they finally do something, and the Bengals had it.
for a minute and 30 seconds, and then it was fumbled away against Pittsburgh in 2015, and then it's really been a bit of a spiral downhill. I'm gonna walk away because I want everyone to walk away with the vision of Mike Brown cruising down Ventura Boulevard in shade. I just want everyone to have that. I love listening to this podcast and hearing from you. So, Alex, hey, man, I really appreciate you checking in with us, and always great to catch up with you on some, especially on Bengals perspective. You're one of the few on the national side that still remember that Cincinnati has a football team and that they're part of the equation. So I always appreciate checking in with you.
Hey, Paul, thanks so much. An incredible job at the Cincinnati Inquirer as well. You've been carrying Jim. I hope you're back. You have that brace, and you're able to go on and continue to make it through another season.
I'll do my best. Thanks, Alex. We'll talk to you later.
Thanks. Bye.
All right, rolling on here with the Bengals Beat podcast, and I am thrilled to be sitting here in the home of legend. Can we use legend? Can I use legend?
I'm just sitting here soaking it all in. You just go right on ahead.
Bengals now retired PR man, Jack Brennan. But really, just to say Bengals PR man is not really fair, because in the Bengals lore, you go back as Bengals beat man, Jack Brennan, back for the Post. And what years were you at the Post?
I got to Cincinnati and started work at the Post in late 1983. And had the Bengals beat from 84 through 89. Then I went to the Inquirer, jumped on the Reds beat for the World Series ride in 1990, and then went back to the Bengals the next year. And then that was through 93, and took the Bengals job in 94.
And from 94 till the 2016 season, there you were, leading the PR charge. It was a pretty smooth transition for you. I mean, did you feel like it was a smooth transition for you, an easy move?
It seemed strange at the time, because at that time, that was an unusual move. It just wasn't being made in the PR and media world. But the Bengals, as you know, are a special kind of a small organization, and Mike and I just had a really good relationship. And I want to say, I was not a homer. The last weekend I wrote, but before I took the, after I'd already accepted the job, I did season-ending grades from a 3-13 year, and I gave Mike a D-. But Mike was the kind of guy, he understood that, and so we moved right into it, and so I was in the same place, doing with the same people, but just kind of jumped to the other side of the fence.
That's the one thing that, from a media perspective, that I've always noticed about Mike in particular, is he really does have a good understanding that it's okay to rip him, and he doesn't mind. He just wants it to be fair. And usually he has a complete understanding of why it would be fair to give a D-, or say that this was a bad personnel decision or whatever. And I don't know how many owners you could say that about, that have that kind of perspective, and certainly not that kind of appreciation for the local media that Mike has.
Yeah, I think he got some of that, or a lot of that just came down through his father, because mm-hmm. Paul Brown was known as an accessible and fair guy with the media. He liked especially the newspaper guys. And he was around, I was on the beat, you know, like 6 years when he was still alive, and was reachable. And Mike understands the adversarial relationship of the media to the team, that the people out there reading the Inquirer, they don't want the articles written by the PR director. The give and take, that some of it's going to be stuff he doesn't like, but overall, even when the teams were so bad, if you look at the daily run of media coverage, everybody's writing about the team and who's going to take over this position, and it still just keeps the team in the news, and which is what the team wants.
How did you feel like Mike handled the 90s? as an, I mean, obviously no one handles that well. But I think this was sort of became an onslaught of negativity that surrounded the team at that point just because they were so bad. And the stadium thing was kind of hanging out there over people. And how did you feel like Mike dealt with that time period?
I guess you could argue that he handled it a little too well. maybe should have gone ballistic or off the rails at some point. But it's very important for Mike to run the team the way he felt like it should be run, according to the principles he should run it. And it didn't work very well for a long time. And he'd be the first to tell you that. But he lets a lot of things roll off his back that more sensitive ownership types would not. And he just kept plugging every day. He lives to run the football team every day. It's so untrue, the criticism he used to get about not being a football guy, because he played football and grew up in football.
It's kind of his obsession. I mean, I don't know how many owners are out in a golf cart at every practice. Not many, I would imagine.
I would think not many. And of all the great things for working with the Bengals, who treated me extremely well, one of the hardest things was, not only are you working every day during the season as a PR director, club employee, the Bengals are not handing out days off like they grow on trees. At the 10-year point, everybody got 3 weeks of vacation, and that was it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I used to get 4 or 5 with the newspaper.
Yeah.
Plus your comp time that you build up, and you don't build up comp time working Bengals PR either.
No, you just build up long hours.
But part of the reason for that, behind that not many vacation days policy, is I've always thought, just in Mike's mind, 360 days out of 365, there is nothing he would rather do than get in his car and drive down to the stadium and run the team.
Yeah.
So I think it's a little hard maybe for him to understand how other people would want to get away from it.
Yeah. just for a couple of days, right?
Yeah.
I'm also curious how things, when Marvin came in 2003, there was a clear move to make Marvin the face of the franchise and move away from Mike being so out there. How was that approached with you guys, and how much was that discussed as the reasoning of wanting to make Marvin the front and center face? Because that was really a big turning point for the franchise, I felt like, in sort of what their public image would be.
Yeah, well, in conjunction with hiring Marvin, and I think Katie and Troy were instrumental in urging upon Mike that Marvin was the right choice, and they probably urged Mike to step back a little bit. And Mike finally decided that after all those years of being out front with the media all the time and trying to be forthright and explain things, but he had a bad team and a stadium controversy which never ends. Mm-hmm. And he just decided that as hard as he tried, and as much as he tried to be forthright and available and speak honestly, in the end, it just wasn't working.
Yeah.
It was a noble effort, but it just wasn't working. He wasn't getting anything out of it. So when Marvin came on and they're really trying to flip things around, I think they just all thought this was the way to go.
And Marvin, you know, obviously it helped that they had success right away. I mean, you had that 2003 season where they beat the Chiefs, who were 9-0 midway through, and draft Carson Palmer, and eventually you have 05 and off you go. I mean, I don't know how much harder it would have been, obviously, if they didn't have the success they did. But how did you feel like it was? Did you feel it was pretty easy for Marvin to sort of embrace that role of it? I mean, from your angle, working with him?
in reality, the whole range of things as an NFL team you have to talk about, and Marvin never wanted to be the spokesman for everything.
Yeah.
I mean, there were clear areas that Marvin just didn't want to talk about it. I'm coaching the team. Man, I can't think of a great example, but just off the field stuff. So then you were kind of left with a vacuum. Marvin didn't want to talk about it, but management was saying that Marvin is the voice on everything.
Right.
So just over the years, that morphed a little bit. Mike would talk sometimes. Jeff Birding could be drafted to be the spokesman on some things, and Bettinghouse could be drafted to be the spokesman on some things. So it wound up with a fairly good mix.
Yeah. So, I mean, over your time around the club, who are some of your favorite people that you've had to deal with that maybe that people wouldn't realize that aren't intertwined in the club, that were just really special guys and ones that, you know, maybe their personalities didn't get as much run as they would have deserved?
You mean like players and coaches?
Yeah.
So not Andy Dalton and not Carson Palmer, because everybody knows. I mean,
if that's what it is for you.
I always think of them first.
Yeah.
Because as the PR guy, you've got to have your quarterback on board with you. And Carson and Andy were both excellent to work with. They had their limits, definitely, things they wouldn't let you go, but they knew what a quarterback was supposed to do, and Carson did, and I guess still does in Arizona, and I'm sure Andy still does as we move on without me at the Bengals. They know that quarterbacks got to lift a heavy load, so they were willing to do that and not be too pissy about it.
So, a big Sed Benson guy, weren't you?
I was a big Sed Benson guy. Cedric, I thought, just related to people. Everybody, media, staff, it was a more human-to-human thing rather than I'm a highly paid pro athlete and you're not.
Yeah.
And even many guys who are not arrogant about it or are assholes about it, still, that's kind of the platform you're on.
Yeah.
And Sed was less that. And I know a lot of the media liked Sed. He oftentimes would really pour his heart out about things.
I'll never forget after he had that great game against the Browns, and they broke their losing streak at the end of the 2010 season. Sed Benson stood in front of his locker with his uniform and shoulder pads on for about 45 minutes as wave after wave after wave of media kept coming up. And I swear he was in tears the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, and just opening it up because it had been a frustrating season for everybody, particularly for him. Sed, if he doesn't feel like he's getting the ball enough, he tends to build up some frustration. And it was one of the more amazing things I've ever seen in a post-game locker room before.
Yeah. Well, I wish he could have been here longer, built up a little more legacy and with the fans, because I think he's, in the whole history of the Bengals, I'm afraid he's still kind of a bit player with the fans.
Yeah.
He was on those teams that made the playoffs. And I don't think he was a favorite of the coaches. I think the coaches found him a little difficult to deal with sometimes.
Yeah. I remember Jay Gruden's first year talking about, you know, when they were discussing rotations of running backs, saying something like, you know, if Sed doesn't get the balls, he'll let you know about it. You know, joking about what his response always was, having to hear from Sed and trying to keep him happy. But, you know, this organization is unique to the NFL, and you see it through the scope of all 31 other teams, whether you're at the combine or whether it was an owners' meetings type, dealing with across the league. I mean, how would you define how different this organization is than the other 31? Because people always ask questions about the Bengals, and I always say, well, maybe in 31 other places this would be the case, but the Bengals are just always through a unique prism because of the family ownership and a lot of the methods of how they decide to operate.
I guess I don't really know in a lot of ways how other teams operate, but I think that they're just more corporate. Everything is more structured and more run, and everybody has performance evaluations, and some PR departments have these big books of plans with structure of how they run things that you run into at meetings sometimes. And we were more just take it on the fly. I was the former newspaper guy who had Mike's trust as to understand and work with the media, and just tried to keep it simple and come in every day and deal with what had to be dealt with. But I myself have never been a big meetings guy or a big organizational planning guy. I had no business background. I was just a common scribe like you.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I was the PR director. So yeah. That had to be adjusted to a little bit.
All right. So who are some other guys, though?
Well, all right, I'm just looking through the media guide of rosters and starters. Starting in 84 when I first got here, Chris Collinsworth deserves all kudos for being a tremendous magnetic personality that he gets. He was tremendous with the media and with the fans, and you know, he's famous big guy right now. And
he is famous big guy.
He deserves it. Boomer Esiason was tremendously interesting to cover. Salty, interesting. The scribes loved him. He and I got into it a couple of times.
Over what?
It was the off season, and something was going on that was kind of making him look bad, but he didn't feel like he had time to talk to me, and his agent kind of blew me off. So I just wrote it, and then he got mad and wouldn't talk to me for a while, but we worked through it and got over that.
Yeah.
Lewis Breeden, the cornerback, a very quality guy. And again, as you always are in situations like this, if I left you out and you were a great guy, it's only because I just sort of missed it.
Yeah.
Let's see. Fulcher was a very interesting guy when he was here, a little bit controversial. David Fulcher had one of my favorite Bengal mantras when he was a good player, but he was into it with Sam Weish, and they always said he was too heavy. David would always say, "Don't weigh me, just play me."
Nice. Coming up with your own catchphrase definitely helps you with the scribes.
Joe Walter, solid as he could be. Bruce Kozerski, great guy, still a great guy in this area. I'm just looking through here. Nah, I don't like any of these guys. Ooh, now we're into the Carl Pickens era. We won't talk about him.
No, we won't. We'll just keep on moving through.
Yeah, we'll move right on past that.
How was Jeff Blake? Because he sort of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And as a young PR guy, you probably were. All of a sudden, you've got this guy who's the third-string quarterback who's this league darling, and I would imagine that was a tough spot to handle.
I don't know. Yeah, that wasn't all that tough. Maybe it's because quarterbacks just are bred to deal with it, but Blake was not the total package that Andy or Carson was, but he, too, still knew what he had to do as a quarterback and would do it. I'll put a slight little knock on Neil O'Donnell when he was here. He was not as easy. He was not as good to work with. I don't know. Maybe that's where he was, you know, in his career. He was a veteran trying to find a new spot, but I would have hoped for a little more from Neil, but that's okay. he had a fine career and was only here, I guess, just 1 year. Willie Anderson deserves everything he got as a salty, friendly, good guy. Willie Anderson is a good example of how players mature and morph. I remember his first year, early 90s, when he was a rookie. What was Willie's first year?
96, right?
Okay, so I was never a scribe with Willie. I was always the PR guy.
Yeah.
But he was a deer in the headlights when he first got into the Bengals. Big old guy with big wide kind of, oh, what's going on expression and didn't want to say anything. But he quickly, his true personality quickly took over and he became a real factor.
I mean, the Willie Whitworth lineage has sort of run on, and the stuff of legend, where really since 1996, there has been a powerful voice of the room offensive lineman, because those two overlapped and Witt sort of picked right up where Willie Anderson left off. And you had a voice of the room offensive lineman that was there every day, sort of no matter what was going on. That, from a PR and from a scribe perspective, is as invaluable as it gets.
Well, one gag I always liked that I came up with, proud of, and I think the media appreciated it too, was that when the media were massing and going over to Willie Anderson's locker, I'd go, beep, 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 because they were all like backing up their trucks to get loaded up with quotes.
And you would have plenty, and they would go on and on and on, as long as anybody wanted them to.
Takeo Spikes was a good factor.
Yep.
Good salty guy, a good player. Let's talk about Chad Johnson for a minute.
Yeah, let's.
How can you not talk about Chad Johnson?
You talk about one of my favorite quotes to ever hear come out of your office was, it had to become a company line, was, we are not in the business of following Chad's tweets. Because people would constantly call you about what Chad had latest thing he tweeted out about, you know, playing soccer or riding a bull or whatever.
Or the best one was that he had a deer in his garage.
Yeah. And you start getting calls.
Oh, yeah. And including from PETA.
PETA called you?
Yeah, they were very, very upset about that. And at one point, I think it was my second round on the phone with PETA, I was sitting in my office, and Chad was walking by, and I waved at him, and he came in, and I said, look, here's Chad. He'll tell you himself this is not true. He just made it up. But Chad brought an outsized glamour to mid-market Cincinnati. No, he was a true sports center NFL star guy. And I'll give him only about a B or a B-minus as a guy to work with, because Chad's very self-absorbed and could not be counted on when you really needed him on a consistent basis. It was all his whim and what was in his mind. But still, overall, he was a good-natured guy and a great source for the media.
Did you know when you first – I mean, 'cause Chad came on the scene in 2001. He had a brashness to him even when he was drafted, but it was different then. I mean, and he became – and Marvin has talked a lot about this in regards to Chad, and he was very much a very different type of guy in the way that he was both with the media and as a player by the time he reached 08, 09, certainly than he was in 02, 03.
Well, I first noticed the real – I don't know what – fire or personality in Chad as a rookie. About eight games into the season, he bunged up a shoulder or something, and he was going to be out for 4 to 5 weeks. And I was it was notable as a rookie how much he warred against that and didn't want to be out and was causing Marvin and the trainers a little problem by not just accepting the program.
Yeah.
So that was the first sign I had that Chad would be that way. And I don't know, you know, then he went on and he did all the outrageous things, and most of them were funny. I love it when the officials were debating a call and he tried to hand the one a dollar.
Yeah.
I thought that was – I know the league had to fine him and they didn't like it, but I thought that was tremendously good-natured and funny. And I always credited Chad for that one.
Let's do this real quick. The 2010 season, from a PR director's perspective – The T.O. Cho Show thing is happening. They are. I remember those crowds in Georgetown for training camp.
Yes.
Broke every record, and it wasn't even close. Was there any way you, as a PR director, could find any way to rein in the T.O. Cho Show, not only on television, but in a daily basis that happened around the team?
I don't know. I guess I reined it in as good as I could, and it wasn't a very effective job.
That was an unstoppable force, though, I think. Yeah, I mean, well, T.O. was sort of an animal all its own.
2010 started out so tremendously. The 09 team, of all the tragic history of all the playoff losses every year, first game every year, we just could not win. That Jets game stands out to me as one we should have won.
Yeah.
But anyway, 2010, you're right, the crowds were tremendous in training camp. The show was great. Chad and T.O. Palmer kind of trying to ride herd over it. But it went bad, and it went bad. It just went really bad. and toxic with the fans is the way I remember that team, because Carson wanted no more of it after that.
Were you guys completely blindsided by the Carson thing from your angle? Because it seemed like everyone was blindsided. Was there a sense inside the organization before that something like that could happen side?
I think that was a total blindside. Yeah. I think for everybody.
Yeah.
And just back to 2010, I know I was told in the organization that the drop-off in season tickets after 2010 was dramatically the worst in team history, and that was why even when the team got good again under Dalton and all those teams, 6 years in a row in the playoffs?
5 in a row, yeah.
It was hard to build up the crowds again to what everybody thought they should have been.
You're right. The season, and then there was the press conference when they brought Marvin back. And then the Carson thing, there was so much negativity out in the air that over the course of – they really just – you're right. It would have taken – the only thing that could have really completely erased all that negativity would have been one of those – playoff seasons getting a win at the end of it, and I think you would have left that behind, but it still sort of simmers because the playoff thing keeps that alive a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, let's not Mike Brown agrees to call a spade a spade, mm-hmm. and it's a terrible albatross not having won a playoff game since 1990. That hangs over.
It does.
It hangs over. And the thing about that, as a fan, you lose the joy of a 10-6 season because you go, well, hell, we were 10-6 last year, and we were 9-7 before that, and we were 11-5. So then the next regular season comes on. All right, so what? We're 7-3. Big deal. We're going to go to the playoffs and lose again.
Right.
There's a hangover effect that is hard to get around.
Yeah, we've covered a lot. Is there anything else that you wanted to say?
A great run, especially from covering the team. They gave us a jersey, Bill Connolly and Bill Scanlon. As you know, some of the fans know who they were. They also were longtime employees who retired, and they gave us all a jersey and they put their number of years with the team on it. And though I worked with the team 23 years, I wanted them to put 32 on mine because I wanted to count my 9 years as a scribe, because, you know, I'm always a scribe at heart.
Yes, yes. There's no doubt about that. And those of us that worked alongside of you really appreciated that, because I would say you might have been one of the few. There's a few out there still, but amongst those in the PR world with teams that still view things from the scribe perspective, I think everybody else views themselves more as the gatekeeper of the team and the players and the protector, mm-hmm. Rather than necessarily always trying to help the scribe. There's plenty of good PR staffs out there. However, I think it's dwindling, the amount that view it through the scribe's perspective. We're more and more able to just be tossed away as more and more media outlets come up and social media and all that stuff.
Yeah, with all you got to deal with and all the controversy, if you can't walk back into the media room and laugh about it all, I don't know how those other guys do it. But they, again, they have more of a business corporate background and outlook, so I guess they don't need to laugh about it as much.
Well, I'm glad. I'm sure you got plenty of time still to do some gags and laugh it up now that you're retired. Jack, thank you again for joining us. It was great to have you. And in case I haven't said it a million times, happy retirement to you.
Thank you very much, Paul.
Do you remember when we fell in love? We were young again in a something. Do you remember how it all began? It just seemed like heaven, so I did.